and then there was one. The last presentation for the convention here is Stephen Reese. I got it right.
Yeah.
He's author of a PhD. He's offered several books, including Touching Base. He's currently writing one, Horse Racing in the Chicago Way, Politics, Crime, and the Turf in the Windy City, 1840 to 1910. Stephen Reese. Nice.
My history in Sabre goes way back. I can't, so far back, I can't remember that if I was at the convention in 73 or 74, but there was one in Chicago, like around then, and I was here. I'm going to first make some comments about what's going on with baseball, money-wise, after World War II. After World War II, there was an enormous pent-up interest for consumer goods, homes, and entertainment. And baseball, like many other consumer sectors of the economy, enjoyed a huge boom, with attendance doubling compared to the war years. Fans were excited to see their old heroes return and compete against new blood. Major league attendance rose from about 11 million in 45 to 18.5 in 1946 and peaked at 20.9 in 1948. A number was not going to reach again until 1962. Right after the war, post-war profits were very high, a record profit of almost 5 million in 46. And in fact, from 46 to 49, Major League Baseball averaged over $4 million in profits. Operating income nearly doubled from 45 to 46 to 27.5 million, thereafter surpassing 30 million regularly. Teams were selling in the late 1940s for about 1.5 million, about double what they had cost in the 1920s. So that looked good. But what happens afterwards in the early 1940s was at least a surprise to me, because baseball was the only game in town. Baseball was doing great, especially baseball in New York. And turns out that the National League actually loses money from 1950 to 54, and between 50, 52 to 56, for which we have data, the National League made a total of $108,000. The American League does better, though it lost money in 52 and 53, but made a total of $3 million during this period. There were exciting National League pennant races, but in cities like cities outside of Cincinnati and Milwaukee, the growth of attendance did not keep up with population growth. So for a long time, the 50s was a struggle. And historian Robert Burke has addressed the question, because we always talk about TV and its relationship. He says certainly television had a big impact, but so did shifting demography with the rise of the Sun Belt, the rise of the suburbs, imbalance among teams, you know, Yankees winning all the time, competition from other sports, paternalistic owners like P.K. Wrigley, and management's scared awareness of marketing. Now I'm going to focus here on two teams that did do really well in this period. Two teams in New York, which is the center of baseball, at least it was when I was a kid growing up, when I came home at 3 o'clock to watch television. Now one of these teams that was really successful had not been very good, and they were the Dodgers. Dodgers were among the least successful National League teams until the 1940s, typically ending up in about fifth place. People remember their daffiness, such as 1926, when three guys ended up on third base. They remember that Giants manager Bill Terry was asked to evaluate the Brooklyns in 34, and he said, oh, I don't know what to say about that. I was just wondering whether the Dodgers were still in the league. Well, by the early 1940s, this had changed, and it was due to Larry McPhail, and we don't have time to go into it, but he brought in quality players, brought in radio broadcasts, Ladies' Day, night baseball, and a pennant in 41. And by then, the Dodgers were drawing 1 million people, one-third more than other New York teams. On the branch, Rickey, who succeeded him when McPhail went off to war, the Dodgers became the top team in the National League. Six pennants and three second-place finishes from 46 to 56. They were the top drawer in the National League at home. They made a lot of money at home because they were drawing 1 million fans almost every year in the 1940s. They led the National League in attendance in the 1940s. In 47, they peaked at 1.8 million, the year Jackie Robinson played, but actually that was only 10,000 more than the year before. So they were doing very well. But thereafter, attendance is going to drop and drop sharply. See if I have that. Oops, wrong one. The next year it loses 400,000 people, and the attendance in the Dodgers is not going to be what you would expect from a team that was doing this well. Certainly the Dodgers are trying to bring in the crowds. They have a big advantage. Brooklyn is one of the largest cities in the United States. It has a tradition of working class fans who stick with the team through thick and thin. Many fans were women. Not as many as fanatic as Hilda Chester, who we had here somewhere. We had Hilda Chester. What happened to Hilda? Poor Hilda got rubbed out. Oh my God. Poor Hilda. Hilda was a real peach. She yelled and screamed. She made lots of noise. She had a booming voice. She had fry pans and ladles and cowbells to make noise. The Dodgers furthered their emphasis on the masses. They supported something called the Dodger Symphony Band. Symphony Band on August 13, 1951, over 2,000 strong, were admitted free on Music Appreciation Night. Fans came to games with handmade cloth or cardboard banners long before the amazing Mets. Peter Marcus, a French historian who wrote a dissertation on baseball, says that these gestures helped the people take possession of Ebbets Field and seemed to take over the club and its destiny. Marquis found a report in the Brooklyn Eagle that 53% of the attendance was men, which meant 47% is women, which is an astounding number. There were mainly adults. About 50% were fans between the ages of 20 and 60, and heavily Italian and Anglo-German. The Eagle apparently didn't find many Jewish fans, which, considering Brooklyn was one-third Jewish, it's hard to understand. What the Dodgers all tried to do was make the team an institution with which fans could identify. This is very important in Brooklyn. Brooklynites had a big inferiority complex. When you were living in Brooklyn and you went to Manhattan, you actually had to get on the subway and there was a sign that says, going to the city. So you're leaving Brooklyn with 2 million people, going to the city, not a very good thing. You looked at the movies. In the movies we had characters like William Bendix, who could barely read and write, but they were Brooklyn cab drivers, unsophisticated, spoke with an unattractive accent. Fans did invert the negative stereotype of the bums into a symbol of pride. For them, the Dodgers were one of the few institutions they could be proud of. The Dodgers also promoted fandom by promoting philanthropy. They tried to curry success with the fans. Branch Rickey was a big supporter of baseball-oriented charities. He wanted to demonstrate the team's concern with local welfare. The main charity was the Brooklyn Foundation for Amateur Baseball, founded in 1946 to fight juvenile delinquency and to fight communism. He wanted to promote American values. The team also created the Knothole Gang, which gave away over 2 million free passes in the 40s and 50s. Of course, the Dodgers got a lot of good ink because they forgot the integration of baseball with Jackie Robinson. The reality is, if you look at the history of O'Malley and the history of Rickey, they are not very socially or politically progressive, in fact, very conservative. Rickey was anti-Catholic and anti-Semitic. As far back in 1918, he reneged on a contract offered to a player when he found out he was Jewish. In the 1940s, Rickey negatively characterized a potential Dodger buyer, describing him as, I quote, of Jewish extraction and characteristics. Now, this is an important table we have here, which deals with National League salaries. Some of you may have seen some of this data elsewhere. There's one column that is completely new. That's the column for 1951. This has never been reported anywhere else. I found this was a report that was supposed to go to the Sell Committee, but never got there. The Sell Committee had also asked, by the way, for 1951 profits and losses, but as far as we know, that also never got to them. This was reported in the New York the New York Times. But readers of the Times would have been confused because it actually cited this as salaries for 1950. So if you're looking for 51, you say, well, this is just something old. But in the Chicago Tribune, in Sporting News, and the Brooklyn Eagle, this was reported as 51. So these are numbers that have never been seen other than me. And I think they will be part of the story we're talking about. Now, the Dodgers were making good money. In fact, from 1947 to 56, they made $3.5 million. The main half of the money came from 47 to 50, the other half from 52 to 56. In the first period, from 47 to 50, the Dodgers were actually the second most profitable team in the National League, and to my surprise, it was the St. Louis Cardinals. In the second part of this era, the competition comes from Milwaukee, which is a big part of the talk today. Milwaukee almost got as much, made as almost as much money as the Dodgers, mainly coming from increases in attendance. But the Dodgers made it from other things, mainly from media. Let's see what we have here. Now, when the Dodgers reported the amount of money they had made to Major League Baseball, let's see if we can go back and find them. They left stuff out, and this was noted by Congressman Seller, who was chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. The data that they reported, and that's what we have here, does not report things like salaries and bonuses of club officials. A club president, for example, made X thousands of dollars. That was a debit, not a profit. In the case of the Dodgers, it was particularly blatant because the general manager and president, Branch Rickey, made a lot of money. In the years he was with the Dodgers, he made $730,000. That appears on the club's record as a debit, not as a profit. Now, his base salary was not that high. It was $65,000. But in his contract, he got 10% of the profits, 10% of player sales, and a bonus when attendance exceeded 600,000. He was thereby the highest paid executive in baseball. Another accounting problem comes up. The Dodgers bought the Brooklyn Dodgers of the All-American Football League in 1948. This went on the books of the Brooklyn Dodger baseball team. In 1948, the accountants wrote up a $300,000 debt from losses from the football team, and they applied it to the baseball team. That's $300,000 more it should have made. In 1950, they wrote off another $167,000. Now, one of the big ways the Dodgers were making money, and this is part of the key to our story, was from radio and television. The Dodgers were very big in this area. And as you can see, they were among the leaders in the in Major League Baseball pretty much every year on this. Even when their attendance is dropping, their profits continue to be really high because of the amounts they were making from radio and television. In 1956, for example, they made almost $900,000 from radio and television. This is the cornerstone of their making money. And this is ironic because when O'Malley goes to California, one of the main things he's looking for is TV revenue, mainly from cable lines. He was already just about the top of the level in Brooklyn when he left. It's not surprising that TV markets were very big in New York. In fact, all the New York teams, as you can see here, did extremely successful. New York had an enormous number of TVs with homes. 2 million by 1950 had televisions. The team in New York, this is one of the great things they had, was they had great announcers. The Dodgers' great major announcer was Red Barber until he got ticked off with the management and went and joined the Yankees. The Yankees had Mel Allen, Giants had Russ Hodges. The Dodgers had their own companies advertising them, particularly Lucky Strikes and Schaefer Beer. The Yankees had Camels, White Owl Cigars, and Ballantine Beer, and the Giants had Knickerbocker Beer and Chesterfield. Now, if we go back to salaries, salaries are actually a smaller component of expenses in this era than they had been before. As late as 1933, for example, 44% of expenses for teams came from salaries. By the 1950s, it's only about 20%. Now, when you look at salaries, I always assume that the teams that were making, that were leading the league in profits and in position in the pennant race would be on top. And to a degree, this is true. But if you look on the tables, you see, no, this is not actually always true. In fact, the Dodgers, which while they had a high payroll, were not at the top of the register in most of the time, only in a number of years. Their tops were, well, it was only 1 or 2 years, 56 after they won the World Series, that was about it. We don't know much about the individual salaries of players, unfortunately. We do know that Jackie Robinson was probably the top player they had, peaking in 1952 at $42,000. Snyder topped that in 1956. This was far below what the Yankee stars were making, particularly Joe DiMaggio, who in 1949 was making $100,000, and they cut him all the way back to $90,000 in 1951. By the way, the next top player, next salary guy in the Yankees, surprisingly, is Phil Rizzuto, who was making over $55,000 in the early 1950s. Now, the big problem for O'Malley was Milwaukee, because Milwaukee, which was a new team, it's a new franchise, it was the first major league franchise to move in 50 years, found nirvana in Milwaukee. They made a fortune. In fact, they made only a few dollars less than the Brooklyns did in the early 50s. And the reason they made all this money was primarily from the gate, secondarily from concessions. They were clobbering the Dodgers, as you can see, games at home, how much they were making. You see one was making a lot more. But you go down to the bottom, net income, you see the Dodgers were ahead. And one of the reasons the Dodgers were ahead was because of TV and radio. Milwaukee's TV revenues were abysmal. The Dodgers were at the top of the National League pretty much forever. The Dodgers in the mid-50s are making 30% of all their profits from media. The Giants, a similar situation, are also New York, they're also championship teams, also making 30% from media. What the Giants are not doing well is they're not drawing well. The Giants are in a declining, located in a declining neighborhood. The team is often mediocre. The Stoneham family is not doing a very good job of maintaining the system, and it's easy to see why he follows O'Malley out of town. Now let me take a look at the Yankees, where the story is also very rich. The Yankees were great. By 1947, the Yankees had won 14 pennants since 1921 and 10 World Series. They were the most profitable team in baseball. In the 1940s, the Yankees made over $3 million. There were not too many teams that were even close to the Yankees, other than, it turns out, the Cleveland Indians. There were a lot of great records available on the Yankees. Fortune magazine in 1945 published a complete record of the Yankee finances, if anyone is interested in that. The American League was a very flourishing business. They made $6 million collectively from 47 to 50. Only the Red Sox were in the red. From 52 to 56, the American League made $2.5 million, with Baltimore, Boston, and Kansas City losing money. In fact, in 52 and 53, the league as a whole lost money. The Yankees in the late 40s made about 42% profit, followed by Cleveland with about 30%. So $3.5 million for the Yankees, $2.5 million for Cleveland. The Yankees led the American League in profits in 1947, 1949, 1950, 52, 53, and 56. The only years they did not in the 50s was when the Indians did. And ironically, the Indians did not have the biggest profit when they won the pennant. It was even next year. The Yankees made money from a variety of sources. They made money from the gate. They had invariably the biggest attendance. They made money from concessions. They made a fortune, almost $900,000 eventually in 56, from the media. They also made a lot of money from the farm system. And they made $100,000 from renting their ballparks, not just in New York, but the minor league teams in Newark, Kansas City, and Norfolk to the Negro Leagues. The Yankees made a lot of money from selling off players. They had a great farm system, they had a great scouting system, and they were able to make money on that, like about $130,000 a year. They also did not spend much on recruiting. They had very few bonus babies, almost none, and that saved them a lot of money compared to other teams. Now, as I said, the Yankees were not always the most profitable team, nor did they even have the highest salaries. Again, you would think the Yankees would always have the highest salaries, but in the early 1950s, the Cleveland Indians paid the highest salaries in 52, 53, 55, and 56. The only year they did not, 54, was the year, ironically, they won the pennant. The Indian payroll was $18,000 a man in 1954, $22,000 in 1955, double the league average. The Yankees were making 1 year $19,000 down to $16,000. Now, there's a good reason why the Yankees weren't getting bigger salaries than they were. And the reason is spelled George Weiss. George Weiss was the general manager of the Yankees. He was a cheap bastard. And there was a reason he was a cheap bastard. He got a percentage of money that the team saved by paying lower salaries. So this is a way of increasing his income. And he had a justification. He says, well, listen, here's the letter. This is what you're going to get. And remember, there's a World Series coming up. That's part of your salary. A Yankee player in the mid-50s was getting about $6,000 a year at the end of the year. This is a bonus. He won the World Series. So you're making it an average $12,000, $13,000. Here's another $6,000. Be happy. Don't bother me anymore. So what do we have with this? The Yankees and Dodgers were unquestionably the best teams of the year in 1947-56. They played in the biggest market. They were highest or nearly highest in attendance. They made the most money from radio and TV. They had the highest profits. Now, despite the Dodgers' excellent returns, O'Malley was an unsentimental profit maximizer. He was concerned about the team's future financial viability and was worried about the altering demographics of Brooklyn and the lack of good facilities for automobile commuters. After the city refused to help him to choose his chosen site through exercising eminent domain, and by the way, when he was coming up with this idea of having the city help him, no city had ever helped a team build a ballpark, except for Cleveland with the mistake by the lake on Lake Erie. And so he was asking for something that was radically new. O'Malley went west in 58 at a time when municipalities did not yet see any reason to help a franchise in town. Thank you very much.